Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's March 20th, 2015. You're listening to the best poker cast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
How's it going, buddy?
It's going very well, I think.
You think? Well, how can you know it's very well and then say you think?
Well, I'll tell you what I've been telling folks. Because, you know, and the nation knows that I'm on the road quite often, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have literally been home since February... 13th since the cruise?
Wow, more than a month.
More than a month, and I'm not going anywhere again until our next cruise on April 10th.
Wow.
And I am going crazy.
I know. You're used to, like, living in an airport.
Yeah. I mean, I got my to-do list for the company. It's down to, like, three things. To two things now, because we just dispensed with one now. And so I'm almost caught up, and then I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, I've got... completely caught up on everything, and I've watched a bunch of crappy TV, and it's killing me. It's killing me.
It sounds like you need to have a home game.
Yeah, well, I've been trying that, too, but it's busy now.
When you're finally free, they're busy.
Yeah. Hey, people are always busy.
Sounds all cats in the cradle, if you ask me.
That's right.
All right, let's get some poker news out here. This at first this kind of confused me, and then I said, "Oh, okay, I understand what's going on here." But MGM Mirage. Well, you know, but sometimes the way you write things too, you know, your notes aren't always clear. But no, I'm kidding. MGM Mirage poker rooms across the country will soon no longer allow cash to play in their poker rooms. In Las Vegas, that means the Aria, Bellagio, but also Mandalay Bay, Luxor, Excalibur, Monte Carlo, Mirage, and the MGM Grand. So it's a pretty wide swath of Vegas. Elsewhere, it includes Beau Rivage, Mississippi, among others. So at first, when I saw this note on the file, I was like, what? No cash in the room? How are they going
to... see, some people couldn't
It's the to-play thing. So in other words, you just can't have cash on the table.
You have to have a credit card or Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'm like, what is that? Okay. And then I started wondering, was it Bitcoin? What are they talking about here? Because there's no way they're doing that, and it's just cash to play. And
yeah, no cash on the table is the company policy. And I don't believe I read exactly when this is going to be implemented. Maybe it already has, but soon. But yeah, so no cash in play. There wasn't a good comment from the company on why this is.
Right.
So we can only speculate. I'm going to speculate that maybe... security or camera coverage. It's probably a little hard to harder to go back to the eye in the sky and see, you know, chips and stuff if it's bills versus chips, right?
Right.
Maybe. I guess that's the only thing I can think of. Or maybe they just want to clean up the tables. Maybe they just don't want big stacks of cash on the tables anymore, right?
Or,
I don't know.
Or I wondered if it created problems at the tables that they started to go back because maybe they log their... every time a floor is called, they log what it was or something, and all of a sudden they're adding up saying, this guy didn't know he had 400 in front of him because the $100 bills were stacked the way that, you know,
right.
You couldn't see it. Maybe there's some problem like that. Maybe people are getting robbed. I mean, I don't know. There's got to be a pretty compelling reason to just all of a sudden come up with this rule.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll be interested to hear if they actually come out and say specifically why it was. But as a practical thing for me, you know me. Every time I sit down at a 1-3 table, I bring a couple bricks with me. You know, this is gonna be a problem for me. occasionally I'll put a $100 bill under my stack at a 4-8 limit game just so I don't have to have you know, another rack of chips in front of me that gets in the way. But this is not going to bother me in the least. But again, I don't play these big, huge no-limit games where they actually have bricks in front of them. So those are going to be the people, I think, that are most affected by it. And we'll see what the reaction is. But I got to say, it's a fairly benign thing, I think. But again, it's easy for me to say it's benign because it doesn't really affect me much. So
yeah, the only time I ever have them in front of me is when I win them off of somebody. And I just put them with my stack. Or sometimes in our game, you know, somebody will buy a bag of Skittles off of me, and I'll put that bag there, you know. But, you know, basically, you're right. It won't affect me much either. I do remember the first time I ever played live in a casino. It was at Foxwoods. And it was a 1-2 game, pretty innocuous, nothing, whatever. But you sit down, and there's a guy across from me, like in the 8 seat, and he had like $700 bills with stacks of chips on top of them. So he must have been there all day, you know. And I just remember the first time I saw a $100 bill go in the pot, I thought, wow, you know, it's like your rite of passage or something. It's a manhood or something. Like, wow, I feel like an adult. You know, all this, you know, when they're chips, it's still kind of like play, like, you know, you're playing a card game or a board game or something. But when you put that $100 bill in there with, like, you know, a stack of reds on top of it or something, I was like, wow, this is real money. You know, you forget sometimes when you're playing chips, you know, but it was the first time I ever was experiencing that. And it hits you pretty hard when you're seeing these hundreds and it's pretty effective too, I think, sometimes.
Well, I think you might have just stumbled on maybe a back office reason for this. And not back office, is the wrong word. Backhand reason for it. And, you know, because one of the things we learn as poker operators, which we are on the cruise ship now, right, too, is I always wondered why it was 4-8 instead of 5-10 in a limit game, right?
Yeah.
It just seemed like 5-10's easier, right?
Because
you have you throw a red chip in right there. But any smart manager will tell you that people are more likely to bet when the pot looks bigger, whether it actually is or not. So that's why you have a lot of these 4-8 games or those kind of things, because the white chips make a pretty big-looking pot in the middle of the table, even though the pot is less than it would be maybe if it was a 5-10 game, right? I think of the other thing, too, where I think you were stumbling on is that people tend to forget when you're playing with chips that they're actual money, right?
Yeah.
You know, but when you start throwing a $100 bill in a pot, now you're starting to like, you know, that's actually real money, even though it's exactly the same thing, right?
Yep.
So I think it's that psychological thing. So maybe this is the way of making sure that they get max rake or, you know, but that's kind of a weird thing, I guess, to say, too, because, you know, aside from these limit games, if you're at a 2-5, 5-10 no limit game, you know, you're probably a time rake at that point anyhow, so you're dealing with max rake. So maybe that's not it, but, you know, could be. But
see, the difference between me and you, I stumble into knowledge, you stumble into the gutter. See, there's a difference between the two of us.
I got to tell you, the gutter's a whole lot more fun than that. but I'll say the first time I saw money at the table, and I know I relayed this story before, but it's been a while. But the very first time, very first trip that Fast and I took together, it was 2004, right after the big moneymaker boom, right? Before we started the show.
Right.
And we went up to Tunica for a WPT event, and, you know, massive tables and tables and tables. And we walked in the room. The first table we saw, there were very few chips on it. It was mostly just big stacks of bills. And I don't know how big that game was, 10, 20, 20, 40, you know, limit, whatever. It was huge.
Yeah.
And people were just money and throwing money in the pot. And I'm like, whoa, this is amazing.
I know.
I haven't seen too many games like that anymore because I don't hang out those kind of things. But I have seen some rooms now where even dollar bills play. That's ridiculous.
That's stupid.
Yeah. I think it should be at least a minimum should be a $100 bill.
You know what would be fun is if High Stakes Poker was still on TV, and what they would do now, you can't play those bricks anymore. Dan Negreanu, you know, that was like his favorite thing, was just heaving the bricks in the middle when he was all in, and now they can never do that again.
We'd have to give him those European plaques.
Plaques. Heave the plaque brick.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this and see what the reaction is, and whether other rooms decide to do it as well too. And like I said, doesn't affect me much, but I'd be curious to hear from our listeners that do enjoy playing with cash, and whether this will change where they play. All right, this is what I love. You know, because I'm a big gossip guy, and I know you are too.
Right? Oh yeah, I read all the rags when I'm in line at Publix.
You know, funny, somewhat related story. One of my best friends asked me about my Myers-Briggs personality test.
Yeah.
Did you take this, right?
No, I've never taken it, but I know what it is.
All right, yeah. So I told her I was an INTJ, and then she sent me this big story explaining who I am, right? And it was scary spot on, right? Except for the part that said that INTJs are loath to engage in gossip.
Huh.
Because I love my gossip.
I love me some gossip.
Evidenced by me adding this next item to the show today. So Pamela Anderson and Rick Solomon, of course, he's the man best known for starring in Paris Hilton's sex tape, which I guess really was his sex tape, right?
Yeah.
They're splitting up.
Aww, what a shame.
And Pamela isn't going quietly. TMZ, which of course you can believe everything they do, but
right.
They really do. They have people everywhere. So, but TMZ reports that Pamela, who obviously is also famous for her own sex tapes, a lot of sex tapes in this.
Yeah, sex tapes everywhere.
Says Rick won $40 million in poker against Andy Beal last year. And folks, of course, know Andy Beal is the banker in the big book that played against the corporation, and we talked about him last week, right?
Yep.
$40 million, she says. And she wants her share, Chris. And to get it, she needs to have a divorce in California instead of what he wants, which is an annulment in Nevada. She claims that they live in California. He claims they live in Nevada. And the difference is, if she gets a divorce in California, she gets her share of that. So I guess my question is, beyond all the salaciousness of this, caught my eye was $40 million that Rick Solomon won from Andy Beal. Are we believing this?
Oh,
or is this one of those things where he just comes up and goes, hey, honey, yeah, I won $40 million off the banker tonight. When he really won, $100,000 or something.
I don't know. It's a good question because Andy Beal was, pushing the limit poker against a corporation. Who knows what game Rick Solomon was playing with him, It's possible that he could have won $40 million in a different kind of game. You know what I mean? Who knows? I mean, Andy Beal was a real good poker player when it came to limit, but I don't know how good he is when it comes to these other games and the amount of money.
So limit that, I mean, why would he even try to play anything else, right?
I don't know. Solomon, how do I know what kind of poker player he is? So maybe he thought
he's got some caches and stuff. I mean, he's one of these things, and I'm not trying to knock his poker play because he could be better than me or better than you or better than lots of people. I don't know, but he's one of these guys, obviously, that he has enough money that he can play
and
get better and play at these high stakes that, people like me and you and I can't, right? So, but I guess what I'm heart pressed is it took we're talking about the corporation again, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about some of the best limit poker players in the world having to pool their money and come together and tag out to beat Andy Beal.
Yeah.
And now we got a porn star that says he's won $40 million himself off of it.
I don't know.
I gotta say, I'm not believing this. I'm not believing this story.
But if it weren't true, then Rick would be easily not have to worry about it. Because he'd just be like, honey, I was making the story up. Where's the money? Show me the money. You know what I mean? Where is it? Just because I told you I want it, that'll never hold up in court. She's got to know that money exists somewhere to actually file it, right? To mention it, to file it, to tell
her
lawyer
about it. Well, this is an interesting point you bring up, right? Because, in a rational thinking mind, that would be that, oh, come on. That was a big joke, sorry.
Yeah.
But I don't know much about this Rick guy, but what I do know is the guy's got an ego, right?
Mm-hmm.
No one goes out and tapes having sex and then sells it. That's ego, right? And so I'm sure if he was embellishing the $40 million, which I'm going to say he is, right? I also don't think he wants to come out and admit that he did embellish it. I think he kind of wants the world to think that he took $40 million off this guy.
I don't know if it's that big of a deal.
If it gets to the point where she actually wins and it ends up being tried in California, then at that point you backpedal and say, all right.
Yeah.
Hey, okay, this was fun for a while, but no, I didn't actually win that. But why come forward and say right now, before you have to, that, hey, I lied to my wife about winning money off this guy? What people believe he did. Because some people probably do believe he did. And maybe he did. Who knows? I don't know. I'm just not buying it.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad you're skeptical. I was encouraged.
I'm not buying
that
any sex tapes either, by the way.
Yeah, I'm not buying them. That's a whole different kind of buying. But you know, I encourage your skeptical thinking, and that's the road to the truth. So I don't know. It's just for her to bring that up publicly, and you know, him to not shoot it down right away. You know, because of ego, he's running the risk of losing $20 million.
No, I don't think he is, right?
We have to come clean
like
sooner
I said,
or
when
later.
He gets to that point, then maybe he comes clean.
That's kind of odd, though. You're just hanging on to a story for as long as possible to hope enough people think you really took $40 million off.
But you're
what kind of ego is that?
Like, actually, I know. It's scaring me that you're thinking rationally.
I always think rationally. It's what I do.
Yeah, okay, so here, regardless, let's plug in. Take Rick Solomon out of the story, right? And let's say Doyle Brunson. Or no, let's say Todd Brunson, right? Because it's a little bit more on his game, right? Todd Brunson won $40 million poker against Sandy Beal. That almost seems unbelievable, doesn't it? It certainly is more believable, don't get me wrong. But $40 million bucks?
I don't know.
About one guy?
I don't know.
The only part of it that makes it believable is Sandy Beal, who I know is very, very, very wealthy. And, you know, it's possible that he could wager $40 million and he'll lose $40
million. Yeah, she, you know, she could be misunderstanding the whole thing, too. That's the thing, though. You know what I mean? He could be like, yeah, at one point I was up $40 million, or, you know, if you count all
my
sessions.
Yeah, but even that's crazy, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if you're adding all of his sessions, but then you're not counting the sessions he's not telling her about, where he lost 38 of it back to him or something.
Right.
You know?
This is one of the things, you know, our former employer, when they got into, like, some story about slot machines and stuff, and they talked about how somebody wagered $1.7 million. And I'm like, no, BS.
Oh, right.
They didn't wager $1.7 billion or a million. They wagered $25,000 or $100,000 or whatever it is and won some and then wagered that back. So, yeah, technically $1.7 million, but they didn't have $1.7 million in front of them at any one point.
Right.
And so maybe, you know, so you're talking about the same thing here. You know, over the course of the thing, there was $40 million transpired, but there was only $1 million involved. That's what you're asking me
yeah.
to believe in.
Yeah, that's a good
or
point.
Or asking me to believe that she believed.
That's what I'm saying. She may not got the whole story in front of her. You know, he may even said something like, man, there's $40 million on the table at one point, and then I had a winning session. And then she's like, well, he won $40 million. You know, or who knows?
All right.
Who knows?
Yeah. This seems fine. I'm glad we get the gossip a little bit.
Yeah, I love your little ego thing there. You think that it's all ego is why he's not saying yes or no to this. It's pretty funny.
I think that's a fairly believable storyline, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, because he's a porn star.
All right, Anti-Up updates are back. Actually, any updates. I screwed that up.
Anti-updates.
Anti-updates are back. And, of course, always one of my favorite events of the year, the annual Deep Stack Charity Classic, the largest charity poker tournament in Florida, and one of which Anti-Up is a proud sponsor every year, is April 19th at Daytona Beach Kennel Club in Daytona Beach. I will be there, of course. And for those of you who came out last year and saw me, I was like bleary-eyed because I had been up all night at a rock concert and flew all the way from Baltimore. Rest assured, I'm getting a night's sleep this time. So watch out. I'm making a run at the final table this year. But if you haven't made it to this event before, you really don't know what you're missing. We both have played in it several times over the years. Tens of thousands of donated prizes, including all expenses paid trips to Las Vegas, raffle and door prizes. All players get a catered brunch and dinner. I don't know of any other tournaments that do that. And are guaranteed a door prize this year. I mean, one of the things I love is I always win a raffle prize because I buy a bunch of raffles.
Every
this year, you're guaranteed.
Every year.
I think it's a raffle prize worth $65. You're guaranteed a winning this year. So
that's unbelievable.
And, of course, they bring in a lot of celebrities. This year, Phil Hellmuth is back. Norman Chad is back. I still have my autograph. Pabst Blue Ribbon Can, one of my highlights in my office right now. Kara Scott is new this year. She'll be there. And they're doing an entire weekend festival event this year with a bunch of other events, too, not just the Sunday event. But this event always sells out well in advance. I actually talked to one of the organizers this morning. Only 50 seats remain right now. They always have more than 600 players for this. So if you're planning on going, go to deepstackcharity.com and pre-register early.
And Vanessa Selps, too, right? Isn't she part of this as well? And
well, they had an event with her. I don't know really whether she's actually there or not. And so I guess we'll find out. But okay. She's not on the list of folks to be there for the big one.
Right.
And let me clarify that website. It's deepstackcharityclassic.com. I'm sorry. Deepstackcharityclassic.com.
Okay. Very good.
But, yeah, it's a great event. So come out there and have fun and win some stuff. And then also a reminder to any of fans looking for a way to win an Antia Poker Cruise package from their laptop, and you now have that option. RaiderPoker.net, a new subscription model online poker site. It's available in 35 states and District of Columbia. Running daily multi-table and single table satellites for a March 29th tournament with a top 20% of the field to win a cruise package for our November 7th sailing out of Tampa. And players are given a set amount of Raiders to play with their $16.95 monthly subscription fee, and you can play as much as you want.
Cool. All right, each week we spotlight a listener who called our hotline at 206-338-6344 or emailed us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Four in Hand of the Week, we'll send them something cool. This week's sponsor is J-Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Antiup. Check out J-Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. Comes from Al in Maryland. So here's a common situation. At the final table, we're all on the money, and the short stack, five or six big blinds, shoves. It folds around to the last player who says, "I'll call without looking at my cards. I'm getting good odds." Of course, he turns over garbage and doubles up the short stack. When this happened last week, almost everyone at the table commented that his call was the proper move, but I said to myself, "No, no, no! Why risk doubling up the short stack with a hand that is likely poor, especially since the short stack's hand is surely above par since he put his tournament life on the line with it? This is nuts. We're trying to move up the pay ladder at the final table. If you don't double the short stack, he'll likely be blinded out in one or two orbits and be forced to shove soon with a lesser quality hand. Am I missing something here?"
Excellent question, right?
Well, yes. And here's something that one of our newer columnists, Mark Bremmett, he's in the middle of a sit-and-go series in our magazine. And he's using that sit-and-go strategy to convert to multi-table. He's telling you how to, you know, take these lessons learned and use them. But one of the things that I really, really liked about one of his recent columns was the fact that, you know, unless you had ace-ace and king-king in a sit-and-go situation when you're on the bubble, there was no reason for you to call an all-in, no matter what hand you had, as long as it was an ace-ace, and even king-king sometimes he even was like a little, you know, hesitant with. And I just thought, wow, you know, there are a lot of times where I would just call with even, like, any decent ace, you know, because I want to knock this guy out and get into the money or whatever, and then... But same thing here. It's similar. It's not exact, but it's very similar. Yeah, why would you want to, just because you're going to move up a pay grade if you knock this guy out, why would you do it blindly because of the pot odds? That doesn't make any sense to me. It'd be, if it's two random hands and you don't know what each person's motive is with their betting, that might be a chance because you've got decent odds. But when you know the guy is shoving because he has to have at least a decent card in there, then it's got to be, if he's got at least an ace and you random, then you're definitely a dog. And so to be a dog just to call because you have the right odds or getting good odds, which I don't even know if he really does have good odds, to be honest with you. If the guy's got six big blinds, I don't think that's really good odds anyway. But anyway, to me, I would at least look at my cards. I'm not going to just call the guy with deuce seven just because maybe mathematically you can rationale some sort of reason for calling. To me, I would never have called there without even looking at my cards. That's ridiculous.
Wow, all right, we're going to have a good discussion here then.
Good.
all right, so a couple things. We're working with incomplete information here, and yeah. I'm not talking about the normal incomplete information of what cards we have. We don't know what the rest of the chip stacks are at the table. We don't know, particularly the guy that's calling. So all that stuff factors into whether he's getting good odds or not, right? But a couple things I'll say is... one, we're not on the bubble anymore, which is kind of a different. Now, we're already in the money now. So at this point, I think people are a little bit looser. I mean, I know obviously our hero here wants to move up a spot, and obviously he's not the big stack or the short stack. So he's not excited about the short stack being doubled up. Though I imagine he'd be ecstatic if the short stack got knocked out, right? So, but, you know, one thing he says is that obviously his tournament life is on the line, so he's shoving with a good hand. And I'm going to have to argue with that logic. Because then he talks about later, you know, he'll likely blind out one or two orbits or be forced to shove with a lesser quality hand. Well, there's a lot of argument to be made that he's already to that stage at 5 or 6 big blinds now, right? Mm. You know, maybe he started shoving at 15 and with his premium hands, and now he's desperate. Now he's just shoving with anything. You know, who knows where you are on that continuum of when you feel like you have to shove with lesser hands. But I would say normally at a 5 or 6 big blind shove, you got a pretty wide range at this point now. I mean, obviously you got your monsters in there, which you're hoping for. Anyway, any ace, somebody's probably shoving there. Obviously any pair. And I think all the way down to like, you know, some kind of suited connector that you hope that, you know, if you do get called, it's going to be by a hand that's, you get a lot of cards, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the range is pretty wide there. And one of the things I read, and I can't remember where exactly it was or where the math is that, you know, when you're talking about specific hands, it's easy to figure out where you are as a dog, right? But you're putting your range against a range here, right? And I think in this situation, I don't think the range is all that far off, no matter what your two cards are. You know, if the hands are face up, that'd be a different story. You know, somebody shoves a pocket aces and shows you, and you're like, "Oh, I'm going to call with anything." That's ridiculous, right? But that's not the case here, right? So I think the odds of you actually prevailing as the bigger stack here are actually better than I think people normally think they are when you consider the range. And if you look at your cards and discourage about making that call because you look at your cards and you've got 9-6 offsuit or something, and it talks you out of making a decision where you should have made, then I could defend not looking at your cards and just making that call. But it does seem weird not to even look at your cards, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, obviously there's math people out there that can figure out all this kind of stuff. You know, if I've got 50 big blinds and the short stack showing a 5 or 6, you know, I could fade that pretty easily, right? And I think the benefit of knocking somebody out, even with a long shot hand, is better than just folding there and letting this guy pick up the blinds and surviving again. Now, if I only have 10 big blinds, that's a completely different story, right? Mm-hmm. And it also depends on the rest of the stack of the tables, too. You know, if I've got 100 big blinds and everybody else is like at 10, you know, everybody's desperate at that point, right? So, I think there's a lot of missing information here that would have changed a little bit. But I would say, in general, I'm not on the no side of this, but I'm not completely on the absolutely side.
Yeah, I mean,
but I'm closer to the absolutely side.
Granted, the stacks of everyone at the table, including the person who calls, is very important in this situation. The other thing is that you could be 10-handed and or 9-handed and places 9 through 4. There's not that much difference in money, so why do I care about moving up one spot now? If I fold here, this guy goes from 5 or 6 big blinds to 6 or 7 big blinds. And so he's still going to be pretty much desperate soon, but maybe someone else will pick up a hand to beat him. You know, just to not look at your cards at all, you know, you'd have to have like 100 big blinds. And say, oh, 5 or 6, but not a big deal.
Wow, I don't think you need 100 big blinds not to look at
cards. Well, I'm not going to have 10, and I'm not going to have even 20.
No, of course
20
not,
is 25% of my stack to take a chance on this guy. So at what number are you happy? 30?
All right, but there's a big difference between 20 and 100.
Well, I'm saying you got to find that number, but I mean, to right, me, yeah. it, for me to not look at my cards.
Yeah, 30 might be it for me, but certainly not 100.
I don't know if I'm going to risk 6 or 7 big blinds without looking at my cards. You know, I just, especially since I'm last to act, so he's not going to get anybody else to call. He's going to move on to the next hand with 5 or 6 blinds again.
You know what I mean? He's going to get a whole other over. That's the other thing you got to remember is when a short stack shoves and gets no callers, he just picked up another round of the table, unless the blinds are going to go up. And that's pretty huge for a short stack. I mean, one of the things I told Al is, I think an interesting thing is to think about this from the opposite side, right? If you've got 15 big blinds, which is now what most people are advocating is when you're shoving, right? If you're going to be in the pot, mm-hmm. Even as much as 20. The leverage, you have leverage at that point, right? Because mm-hmm. it depends on the rest of the ship stacks. But generally in a tournament, if you're shoving with 15 big blinds, you've got some leverage there because most players can't call you and lose without significantly hurting their stack. That's why you start shoving that early, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than waiting at 10 big blinds or 5 big blinds. When you're at 5 or 6 big blinds, you've lost your leverage now, right? Now the leverage shifts to the bigger stacks because they know if you're short stack and they call with any kind of garbage and they hit their hand, you know, let's say it's like an ace queen, you got 9-6, you've got two live cards, right? All you got to do is hit a 9 or a 6 and fade the other ones, and then you knock that guy out. So the leverage shifts now to you at that point. And I think that's the big difference here. And this is one of the things that I think our listeners have hammered in on me for a while, too, is I've gotten all the way down to 5 or 6 before I got desperate, and that's not good. I mean, I was missing leverage spots at a higher chip stack where I could be shoving.
Right, well, we don't know
the
circumstances.
5 or 6, now you're just,
you know, we don't know the circumstances of how this guy got to 5 or 6 big blinds.
Exactly, right. You know, and that's one of the things that we always tell people, too, is, you know, if you've got 100 big blinds, you just take a brutal beat and you get down to 5 or 6. That's a different story, right? But if you started with 50 and then blind down to 40 and 30 and 20 because you're playing tight, now you're down to 5 or 6, and now all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, now I got to shove. I mean, the 5 or 6 is not enough. It's not enough. So you're going to get a lot of people that call, and there are some people are going to think they have odds and be wrong, but I think more often than not, people will have the right odds to make that call.
Well, I mean, the other thing, too, is when you said, okay, so let's say we fold and he picks up another round. Okay, well, one, the other 8 players at the table also are going to be able to play for that round. So now you're going up against 16 cards every single time that guy has a chance to shove. I mean, I like my odds of those 16 cards coming up with a better hand and having the right reason to call rather than just because it's mathematical.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, I mean,
yeah, I'm not totally saying you have to be the table captain here. There's an argument for not being the table
right.
captain and just be like, you got to knock people out.
Right.
But I do think the people do mistakenly think that they're a bigger dog than they really do because, I mean, the perfect example I think of this is Al is convinced that this guy has a big hand, the short stack.
Mm-hmm.
He could. Doesn't have to, though. He could be just desperate now to, like, you know, hey, I'm going to take a shot. I got to take a shot now. I mean, I've seen a lot of people shove with, like, 7 deuce, you know, because they just fear, hey, I'm going to shove and people are going to fold. And that's stupid, I think. But, you know, you can't necessarily put this guy on a strong hand because he's got 5 or 6 big blinds and shoving. You can't.
The other thing, too, though, is the comment when he says, I'm getting good odds. These aren't good odds. No matter what you say, it's not good odds. Because at best, you're going to be 60-40 dog. You know what I mean? In your mind, you're going to be a dog. Without looking at your cards, you're going to be like a 60-40 dog. If you're calling a 6-blind bet to win 8 blinds, you're not getting good odds. So there's not good odds here. And so to me, it's not a good mathematical situation. So why not just fold and move on and let him do it the next round? Someone else picks up ace-king or king-king.
But you're also talking chips for a pot, and you have to factor in the fact that we're knocking somebody out and maybe moving up a pay spot, or at least, I mean, there's some value, obviously, in eliminating a competitor, right? Because, you know, I know it's kind of cliche, but it is the chip in the chair is valid, right?
Yeah.
You know, if I have one chip left, as long as I keep winning, I can win the tournament, right? So you know, at this point in the tournament, I mean, early on, it don't really matter. But at this point, you know, there's something to be said for eliminating opponents and not letting somebody get on a crazy, ridiculous tear, and doubling up twice or three times, and now all of a sudden taking the chip lead away from you.
Well, can you have
an opportunity to take somebody out?
Not to belabor this, but let's just do the other way around now. So now there's a chance of doubling him up, and what his increased ability to win this tournament now has now raised 100%. You know, you've literally doubled them up with crap hands.
Again, that's wrong math. I mean, his chip stack has increased 100%, but his chance of winning the tournament has not increased 100%.
No, the stack has.
If this guy wins, now he's got, if you throw a small blind in there, he's got, what, most 13 big blinds? Mm-hmm. He's still short stack. He's still got the shove.
Now he's got
nothing really changed for him, other than he's got a little bit more leverage than he did before. But he's still a short stack, so...
Well,
that's the other way of looking at it.
I would
not
look
really
at my cards.
Helping this guy by dunking. Well,
I think the moral of the story is look at your cards.
Okay. Well, yes, exactly.
Look at your cards first. just look
we
at
can
your
agree
cards.
On that.
Let the cards talk you out of it, if it can. All right. Find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. We'll have Golden Nugget Las Vegas poker director Sam Minatello tell you how he would have ruled. This week's sponsor is PokerRadius.com, poker's newest social networking site and home of the Anti-Up group discussions. It comes from Gino. He said, what is the rule in a tournament when on the river the first person to act bluffs, gets called, and mucks his hand? Obviously, the caller wins the pot, but if there is collusion between the two players, we'll never know. So if it's mandatory to show all in hands face up to prevent collusion, then what is it to stop this scenario to get around chip dumping? Can anyone ask for those cars to be pulled out of the muck, which I know is considered bad etiquette? As you know, online, the hand is always shown.
Sam says, this is a very good question. I feel that players tend to overthink the collusion factor. I've seen this in my tournaments, but it's on a very seldom basis. The floor is notified 95% of the time because of the uniqueness of the situation, and we monitor it if it's something that happens on a regular basis. It 100% of the time, never a regular basis.
Yeah.
However, if this did occur more than once between the same two players, we would go through the proper steps to ensure that there was no collusion. We cannot force players to table their cards, but we can look into any signs of colluding between the two players.
Okay. Yeah, because it's, you know, if the person bluffs on the river, it's not, he's not all in, then you can't force right. somebody to show. I mean, yeah, you legally or whatever you want to say, you could say, hey, okay, I want to see those cards or whatever, and then see what, you know. But going into the muck form and stuff, yeah, you're starting to push the parameters of.
Well, it's kind of a sticky situation, and I get where Gino's talking about. He understands that it's considered bad etiquette just to ask to see the hands, which most players don't understand, so I'll give him credit for that.
Right.
And, you know, the advice we always give and Sam always gives is that if you suspect collusion, then you can ask for it, right? So I think where Gino is, he's like, I'm in between this, right? He's like, I'm not necessarily suspecting collusion. But the fact that we're not seeing the cards makes it possible that there is collusion that no one's asking and looking for, right?
Right.
So that's kind of the tough thing. And I think I guess you're just going to figure that out as a player, is at what point do you worry about collusion to the point that you're going to be the one that speaks up and says, hey, not accusing anybody of anything, but that seemed like a fishy play. Can we look at the cards?
Yeah. Yep.
And I think every player has to decide on their own where that level is. But.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right, we've got a brand new O'Malley's move this week. Very exciting stuff. Here we go.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we're at a 2-5 casino cash game. We've been playing well and running lucky, and as a result, we've more than tripled our buy-in. We sit with 1,700 and have an image of the table captain. However, this has given us somewhat of a target on our back. So while we can push some of these players around, others have been playing back at us somewhat regularly. The blinds post, the under-the-gun folds, and the +1 calls. The MP folds, and we're next to act with the ace of diamonds, queen of clubs. We make it $20 to go. The hijack and +1 both call, and we're going to a flop with about $60 in the pot. The 10 of clubs, 9 of clubs, 6 of spades comes down, and the +1 checks. This would normally be a situation where we'd put out a continuation bet, but with one to act behind us, we decide to check. The hijack checks as well. With $60 still in the pot, the turn is the ace of spades. The +1 checks again, and at this point, we decide to make a bet. We lead out for $40. The hijack, a loose aggressive type with about $400, makes a raise to $125. The +1 folds, and it's on us. The hijack knows how to play, but can overplay at times. However, he has been known to set traps and is the type that sees us as a target, not the captain. What is it this time? What's the move?
It's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at antiupmagazine.com. This week's sponsor is Smapsoft, creator of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products. Download the app today by visiting the iTunes store. And this comes from Keith, and it is a hand from the World Series of Poker circuit main event.
Circuit main event.
Okay. Yes.
Slightly different. If it was a real main event, I'd be too nervous.
Right. Well, I'm still a little nervous.
Yeah, I am a little shaken, actually, so... Take it easy.
all right. It's a 1675 buy-in. He said 670 entrants, including a large number of regional pros, along with a few recognizable big names like Phil Hellmuth and TJ Cloutier.
Nice.
It's day 1B with the main event scheduled for 3 days. Starting stacks are 20,000 units. Levels were 40 minutes. And this question, hand in question occurs during level 9, which is 300 to 600 with a 75 ante. plays nine-handed, and he said after a few eliminations, the play is fairly solid, but leaning slightly toward being more loose, stationy. He says, for example, it's been tough to sneak bluffs or steals through.
All right.
So people got their BS radars on full alert here. And it sounds like you gotta earn a pot, as E.F. Hutton would say.
Okay.
All right. The hero is a late 20s, early 30s black male, local pro, familiar to the casino staff. One of the dealers congratulated the hero on winning event one of the series earlier in the week in full hearing of the table. Hero has 65K to start the hand and is the table chip leader. All right, so obviously people know this guy has game because
he's
the dealers are calling him out, right?
Yeah.
All right, villain is a 40-ish white male playing tight, solid poker to date, having shown down only good hands and has 50K to start the hand.
Okay.
All right. The villain opens under the gun for 1,500 and it folds around to the hero on the button with 7 of spades, 8 of spades. At this point, you interrupt the hand for your commentary.
Yeah, I know. I'm just giving it some thought. Well, he's in position, right? You said he's on the button?
On the button. Yeah. The best position to possibly have.
Yeah, he's in position. Nice little suited connectors. Type of hand that, you know, could take a player out, really. I don't know about re-raising here. You already have the position. You're probably already going to be isolated with this guy. You're not going to steal it from him. He's under the gun and making that raise. He's not going anywhere. So I would probably, because of this guy's being a player and using his position, obviously he's a good player at Nolan Hold'em. So he's going to call and probably play the player. And if he can just happen to pick up a hand with those suited connectors that would surprise the under the gun guy, then that's more bonus. But I think that he's probably playing the player here and hoping that these cards could do some damage too. So I'll call.
Oh, yep, so am I. I think you're right. There's no reason to poke the bear of an undergun raiser, particularly a player that's been playing tight, solid poker.
Yeah, exactly.
Hand, right? Yep. All right, and that's what we do. With suited connectors and the button, we decide to call in position, hoping to flop a big draw or float and steal later. Both blinds fold, and we go to the flop with 45-75 in the pot. The flop is the king of spades, 8 of hearts, 6 of diamonds, and the villain checks to us.
Doing checks. Well, to me, and all the books that I've read over the years, and I've stopped reading poker books, but when I did read them, they all would say, if somebody under the gun raises preflop and then checks to you...
Checks?
Yeah. Generally, it's fishy. Right. It's fishy. A lot of people say, oh, he must be scared of the king. He's got queens. Let's bet and steal it. But I'm not buying that. It seems a little fishy to check. I know we've got middle pair and backdoor flush draw and backdoor straight draw things going on here. But most of these guys who are good players who can take down these circuit rings and bracelets and things like that, they're all about pot control. And when you're playing connectors, you know, you're going to want, if you're going to get a free card, you might want to take it, you know. To me, if I bet out now and then this guy comes over the top, I'm screwed. I have to let the hand go. You know, if he did end up hitting a set of kings or something. So again, just like it was pre-flop, I don't see any reason to just bet here because I don't think we're going to get him to fold for one bet. You know, especially if it was fishy and he did hit it hard, then he might raise us. And then, oh, there we go. Now we've just wasted another, you know, probably 2,000 if that's what we're going to bet anyway. So I feel like a check's in order. I don't know why. I know I have position, but I feel like I've gotten some information here. I feel like, why would he not take control of this hand? It says he had control of it pre-flop, and he showed under the gun strength, and now he's checking. It could be that he has queens and is afraid of it, but even then, I think you still muster up a continuation bet when you have 50K in front of you, and it only takes 2K to get some information out of the other guy or something, or to say, hey, I'm going to continue as the, you know, as the aggressor in this hand, and he didn't do that. That just seems fishy to me. So I might check behind and see what happens on the turn.
Yeah, I think at this point, this guy gave us another free card. We already hit one card on a hand that, you know, didn't seem likely that we were going to hit, right? So if he's going to give me a shot to hit, you know, trips or two pair, I'm willing to take it. You know, obviously, I'm still worried that this guy has pocket kings and it's just, you know, doing what you're saying, you know, slow playing instead of you know, betting out, which I think is really the new standard now, is the bet out even with your monsters, rather than do this fishy stuff, because most of us know it's fishy, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, he's giving me a shot to improve my hand. I'm going to take it. I don't see how betting here... I mean, any hand he has other than... I mean, even like a queens are probably going to make a loose call here, right? I would think so. You know, you're not going to get a bit of fold here, and I don't want queens to call right now.
Right,
so
right.
I'll take this free shot and hope to improve and see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see. With middle pair and backdoor draws, we bet $2,500, hoping to take the pot right there. Villain thinks for a bit and calls. I guess we got lucky we didn't get raised.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, our concern, right? If this guy was slow playing and waiting for us to put some dead money in the pot and then take it down.
The other concern is that he does have a monster.
Exactly. At this point, there's really nothing to really worry about, right? I mean, other than some weird straight draw that doesn't make sense. So, yeah, if he's got pocket kings, he's happy to call.
Yeah.
And the thinks for a bit would be a Hollywooding, right?
Hollywooding, so, yeah. Yeah. All right. Well. I don't know. I don't know if I agree with the bet, but we'll see. I mean, the guy's got a ring. I don't, so.
Turn is the seven of diamonds. So our board now is king of spades, eight of hearts, six of diamonds, seven of diamonds. 95-75 in the pot, and the villain checks to us, and obviously we have two pair now.
Yeah, now we're going to get in trouble. Because you know what's going to happen is he's going to either have that set, or he's going to have his own pair, and then the board's going to pair the six or something, and or even the king. And we're going to get into trouble here. But I mean, I can't not bet two pair. The whole reason why we played the hand was either to take, you know,
plus
take
the board got
from,
scarier now, too.
Yeah.
Right? You got straight possibilities, you got additional flush possibilities, so.
You said there's like 9.5 in the pot now?
95-75, yes.
I guess I would probably bet like $6,000 or $7,000 here. Maybe $6,000.
Seems about fair.
Yeah.
Alright, let's see, we say we now have two pair figured to be ahead of the villain's range, which would seem to be heavily weighted towards one pair hands. With the board becoming more draw heavy and the likelihood that we're now ahead, we bet 4,000 and our check raised to 11,000 by the villain.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to call. I'm trying to put him on a hand now, and you could easily just say set of kings and be done with it, and then, but I just
that's the only hand that we're dead to, right?
Right, it's the only hand that we're specifically losing to unless he has 6-6.
Well, dead to, right? There's no
we're dead to, yeah, dead to, yeah. Right, right. So
everything else, we've still got, you know, boat outs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the only hand we're dying to is King-King. Yeah, I'm going to call. I don't like this, but, you know, because it just felt fishy from the beginning. Oh, I flopped the top set of kings. I'm not in really any danger here. Let's check and call and check raise when we can on the turn, you know, and
check raise easily could be ace king here too, right?
I don't know though.
We're just making a shot. It does seem kind of weird though that we'd be at 2,500 and then come back and bet 4,000, which is kind of an under bet, isn't it?
Yeah, it felt like a smallish bet to me. But the check raise, I don't know if it means ace king. Maybe it does. To me,
all I'm saying is it could.
Yeah, I would think I would bet out with ace king when that board got even scarier. I wouldn't want to risk another free card by not betting there. So, but a set of kings, maybe. Maybe you played long enough with this guy who's won a ring that you know he's going to keep being aggressive on the button, and you knew he was going to bet. I don't like the check raise. I don't feel like it's ace king. It really feels like aces, you know.
I mean, the problem is aces is actually a hand that we beat, right? But other than that, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of hands that this guy is making this check raise with.
Yeah.
That we can beat, right? I mean, it seems like a set of kings. It doesn't matter if it's a set of something else. It doesn't matter, right? We're still drawing thin.
Right.
I mean, if it's a set of sixes, we still got outs. But
if it's the case, eights, we're screwed, too.
Exactly. Or the sevens, right? Yeah. I mean, well, actually, no.
No. It's really just king-king is the one that... I mean, 8-8 could be out there and we could be drawn dead.
But there just doesn't seem like many other hands that this board's connected with, right?
Right.
I mean, unless he's really loose with a two pair like we were, which doesn't make sense under the gun for somebody who's described as tight, solid.
Right. It feels like that.
So that's kind of the other thing, too, is, you know, at this point, I pretty much got to put them on Ace King or Aces to feel comfortable where I am right now. Or just that he's trying to bluff us, which doesn't really fit his MO, right?
Yeah, that's kind of an odd way to bluff too.
Type player, and I'm out of position. Do I really want to try to outplay the best player at the table when he's in position?
Plus, a check raise bluff doesn't happen very often. You'd have to know that he's gonna bet and that he's gonna fold to your bet. You know what I mean? It's like you have to be clairvoyant to do a check raise bluff almost on the turn there. So it doesn't feel authentic either. So feels like
gotta say I'm a little worried here now. It's not just because I'm thinking it's king. I don't see any other likely hand besides ace king or ace ace that I can beat right now that would play this way.
Right.
Maybe I'm getting played, but.
Well, we got
and that's tough because we got two pair here, right?
Yeah, we got two pair. Yeah.
The problem is just that anything that we prove to is probably not going to improve us. That's the other problem.
Yeah, if he has the set of kings are drawn dead.
I would feel more comfortable if there was two spades on board rather than two diamonds, because then at least I had flushes I could prove to, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's kind of a dangerous spot here right now. So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of happy that we only bet 4,000 here instead of the six or so that we were talking about.
So, are you saying you would fold to the check raise?
No, I'm saying I'm going to think about this a lot harder than I think most people are.
Okay. So it's
but again, I guess I'm just trying to figure it out. I mean, at this point, it's kind of gut check. I gotta look at this guy and say, hey, is this ace king aces or is this anything else which seems to have us crushed? Well, it'd be really tough to fold this. I think it'd be really, really tough to fold this.
But. Yeah, because you're calling 7 to win 24 ish. So you're getting
but
good
then you got
money.
A river bet too.
Yeah, no, I know.
What's going to come on the river is going to make us comfortable, right?
Yeah.
7 or 8 is going to give us a bow. It's going to make our hand better, but may not make our hand better. It may make our hand worse.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really matter because it's not going to help us. But that's kind of the problem. It's not so much the 7,000. 7,000 we can fade. It's at that point it's going to be 31 in the pot. So yeah. We're going to be facing one another at least another 15.
Yeah, I feel like I know.
That's if we think this guy's making a move and then he just checks the river and then we can just check behind, but...
It's really tough to fold. Like, if I'm playing this hand fresh, I'm playing it the way I play it, I think I would call. Because if it's hand of the week, we're always leaning toward folding because we know guys generally send in hands that they can't understand how they lost this hand. They want to know what they could have done differently. So when you read these, you're saying to yourself, the monster under the bed is there, the monster under the bed is there, because it's hand of the week, it's hand of the week. And it's hard to get away from that thought. And you think, the only hand that beats us here that's legitimate, that has us drawing dead, is kings. And what could suck is if he has ace-ace, and then a six comes on the river, or an ace comes on the river, and then we're screwed.
True.
But
right.
Really, it just feels like only one hand beats us here. Now, granted, that one hand seems to be the way this was played. When you think about the under-the-gun raise, the check on the flop, which is fishy, and then the check raise, because he can do that with a set now. Because he's basically telling you, you can have a free card there. And I don't care. If you checked behind, it wouldn't matter to me because I have you crushed. So that's why we would think king. So, but if I'm playing this hand live and I've got two pair and I'm in position and I didn't know this was going to be a hand where I'm going to get my ass handed to me, I'm going to call this bet and then hope that the river, he gets scared that I called, they tried to bluff or take it away from me, or that his ace-ace isn't good. And then we check it down because the pot's big enough, and I take it down with two pairs. So I really think I'm calling, if I'm being completely honest here. So I'm calling just because I don't know what the end of the week is.
I think most people would, too. So let's see. He says, at this point, we can probably put the villain on a pretty good hand. Ace, king, ace, ace, flop sets. There aren't too many two-pair combinations that we seem likely, especially given our holding of 7-8.
Right.
We're going to be behind a set sometimes, but more often we'll be heads of hands like ace, king, and ace, ace. We only have to call 7,000 to potentially win 25,000, and we'll have position on the river, and we have four outs to make a boat if we're wrong. Again, those last two things, I think, are flawed thinking,
right,
I think, right?
Right.
Because it's not 7,000 to win 25,000, because you got to factor in a river bet, and the four outs are only going to help us in certain situations. But, all right. The river is the 5 of clubs, so our final board is king of spades, 8 of hearts, 6 of diamonds, 7 of diamonds, 5 of clubs, 31, 5, 75 in the pot, and the villain bets out 15,000.
So really, does the guy have 9-9? Does he really have 9-9? And he was scared of the king on the flop. Then he calls because it's still its own second pair, and he didn't believe us. And then he check-raised because he picked up the straight draw and still doesn't believe us. I mean, is that really what happened here? Because
well,
I would maybe
you know, now that I think about
keyboard.
It, I didn't think about this, but I kind of dismissed queen-queen, jack-jack, 10-10, 9-9, you know, because you can't, you got to think of, the villain can't always assume that you have a king, right? So now he's check-raising with a, so those hands we all had beat as well, too. Obviously, pocket nines we were crushed now by, but yeah, I can't believe I didn't think about those other hands, which is probably more of a reason to make the call, which we did, so... but yeah, now we got to figure.
3-1 on your money, and you've got your own two pair. 5-4-4 isn't likely, so it's 9-9 or a set of kings are the only hands that will conceivably beat us that were legitimate. I don't think 6-6 would have been under the gun, and but maybe, I don't know. It just feels like makes me sick. So 15 to win basically 46. 3-1 on my money, and I've got two pair. And if I lose, I'm down to like 45 or so. Oh, man. I think I call. I think I'm going to make a hero call here and be wrong.
What's interesting about this is probably our thought process on the turn should have been when we were talking about that you had a riverbet coming up is guesstimating what that riverbet is. And factoring that in, right? So our hero said 7,000 to potentially win 25,000. And I forget what I was guessing the bet would be. I thought I said 15, which is what it ended up being. So let's just say it's 15, right? So really, I think the turn, the math we need to do was 22,000 to win 55,000, right? Which is about 50-50, a little wider.
50. Yeah. It'd be 57,000, I think. We had with 31 in the pot, and then 15 would make it 46, and your 15 would be 61,000. So you have to call 20. So you're still getting 3-1 on your money because you're still
3-1. All right.
So you're still getting the same, pretty much the same thing.
Okay. All right, and that's fair. We just kind of didn't go through that the math, but but had we done that, then I think at this point you got a call here, right?
Yeah. I just
we were
I
comfortable with that. I mean, this. What we were worried about was some kind of card that completed something. It, you know, yeah, this guy has a nine or something. That's, you know, more power to him. But that's not anything that we were considering, right? So this card really doesn't change anything. So if we were ahead on the more than likely. If we were ahead on the turn, we're still ahead now, right?
Right. We're hoping
behind,
for aces.
We're obviously still behind.
We're hoping for aces or ace king. And we won't be terribly shocked by King-King or now 9-9. 9-9 didn't even come into my mind because of the backdoor way it came in like that. So that's a real disguised hand. But to check raise on a straight draw, that's kind of weird too. Is still a king out there? Because he's running the risk of us now raising him again because we've been being pretty powerful. I know 4,000 was a huge bet, but we've taken control of his hand. And if we have a king in our hand, we might raise him again. He's running the risk of not even having a chance to see that river. So check raising a nine doesn't seem too likely, especially given the little scenario that we were given before the hand started about how he plays. So, yeah, I'm just going to call, and if not, I'm going to build my stack back up. I'd still have, you know, about 40-something thousand with the blinds at 3 and 6, so 3,600. So I can probably
plenty of play,
back
right?
Up. Yep. Yeah.
All right, so our hero tanks, and there's no flush on board, but any 9 or 4 makes a straight. Would have been difficult for a hand with a 4 to make it this far. Hands with a 9 are a little more feasible, but King 9 and Ace 9 probably aren't opening under the gun. Maybe 9-9, and we still have the sets to worry about and the bigger two pairs. In the end, after a few minutes of thought, we think we are ahead more often than we are behind here and getting 2-1 on our money to win a huge pot that would give us a sizable advantage over everyone else at the table and cripple our closest rival. If we lose, we'd still have over 30 big blinds. We decide to call and are shown ace of diamonds, 9 of diamonds.
Oh, no way. No way.
Well, there were 2 diamonds on the turn, so, I mean, the rest of the hand doesn't make a lot of sense, but...
So this guy who's supposed to be this tight player, under the gun, raised with ace-nine, and then on that flop when he has nothing, he calls our pretty decent-sized $2,500 bet. And then, okay, so he picks up the straight and flush draws on the turn. But then he checks that and then raises it too. Wow, what an odd way to play that hand. I can't even fathom. How are you supposed to play against somebody like that? I mean, really.
All right, so our submitter says, now for the good news. This is one of those reverse roll hands, Chris.
How'd you play that way, buddy?
I was actually the villain. I thought the hand would be more interesting to analyze from the other perspective. He says, a local pro could not have put me on a hand and muttered to himself, I really had you on queens there, before deciding to make the call. He never really confirmed me what he had. Pretty sure he would have 3-bet with ace-king and thought king-queen might have been a possibility. But going back to the hand, 2 pairs seemed to make the most sense, so that's what I rolled with. So he invented the hand. That size of the hand. He said, I ended up going on to finish day one with 96.6K, which is good for 35th place. One card dead in day two and busted out around 110th, with 73 getting paid. For what it's worth, the local pro hero was able to rebound and finish day one with 80K and end up cashing.
It seemed kind of suspicious when he's telling us about a hand through someone else. You know what I mean? Like, how does he know? You know what I mean? It was kind of weird that the hero was somebody that wasn't our person. You know what I mean? To say it. And then the villain wasn't our person either. It's like he was watching it from the sideline. It just seemed kind of suspicious. I had a feeling he might reverse that whole role on us.
But what we do know is what Keith had, and not that I like to criticize our loyal listeners, but I think he took a big chance here, didn't he?
Sure.
Raising under the gun with ace nine.
Sure.
Against, and then getting called by what is arguably, at least what we've been described as, is the best player at the table. And, smartly slows down on the flop, but then decides, hey, I want to see if this guy's got anything on the turn. But at that point, I guess the turn check raise, I would say, if I'm an amateur player, which I clearly am, I think these are the kind of chances you got to take against a more accomplished player, right? You know, we had the diamond draw, we had the straight draw, and we just happened to get lucky and hit it. I don't know what our hero would have done had he got re-raced.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
That's the danger here, I think. But clearly he put doubt in this pro's mind of how he was going to play, and this is exactly what pros tell you. They hate to play against people that they, quote-unquote, don't know what they're doing because they can't put them on hands.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I know that I couldn't play against Keith. I mean, the ace nine is not a great hand of the gun to raise with, but you did it, so now you've taken control of the hand, and now you got to live with it. But then that flop comes, and you don't see bet. And then after that, on the turn, you get lucky and pick up a draw, but then you check, and you check raise, thinking he's going to bet you. You can get pushed off that hand. You know what I mean? Check call. Why raise? What's the point of raising there? Because you want to build a pot to win with you know what I mean? Maybe you're trying to set up the fact that you could bluff on the river, but this guy's got 2 pair, you're not bluffing him. I not that he knew that, but obviously if we're calling you, you know, and your check raise, we call your check raise, you have to hit your hand now. I just don't know what the check raise point
well,
is.
Well, yeah, I think the flaw here is, again, it's the story that we're trying to tell, right?
Yeah.
Which is always the most important thing. And, you know, if you go back to our discussion, if you rewind the tape and listen to our discussion before we knew all this, right? We were having real trouble trying to put the end of the gun player on a hand, right?
Right.
You know, we're talking about ace-ace or ace-king. We're talking about maybe king-king or flop-set. It just seemed weird. In the end, we ended up deciding to call, right? Because it seemed like what we thought we had was good. Who knows what the guy really had. If he put us on queens, then, you know, he probably didn't have a hand as strong as we thought he had.
And he also said, did he say somewhere in there that you said that he was trying to sell it as 2 pair? But there's no way you could sell this hand as 2 pair. There's no way you would have raised under the gun with any of those cards to make 2 pair.
Right.
Did I hear that correctly? I want to make sure I heard that. Is that what you said?
I don't necessarily remember that, but there's a lot of type here. So
well, I thought you said something about I was trying to convey 2 pair and I went with it or something like that. So I'm like, if you thought you had 2 pair, I mean, there's just no way you make 2 pair on this hand as the under the gun razor the way you played it.
No, he's talking about going back to the he and two pair seem to make the most sense for the villain.
Oh, the villain. Okay. So, you know what? That's confusing me because I'm thinking the villain was the under the gun player again. I'm getting back to that. Right. See, stop trying to confuse us with your.
It's so easy to confuse us. You don't have to try. We're going to confuse ourselves.
And the one thing I want to end with here is, why did we need to know the race of the players? Why did we need to know that one guy was black, one guy was white?
Actually, I don't know.
I don't know what that meant. I don't think that means anything.
It's a new Ferguson lifestyle.
Yeah, that means nothing to me. I don't know. But from now on, you don't need to tell us what their nationalities or races are of people. That's fine with me. But an interesting hand. Stop reversing it! I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.